This is the second part of The Lapse of the Gods, Power, Sexuality, Publishing and Literature, an exploratory essay. Otherness in art has many different aspects, some elusive and worth some pains to define. I'm thinking again of Tolstoy's observation, intrinsic to my last essay, that he could wish one thing for people, it would be that they could cease work for a while and contemplate their lives. An imaginative transition from the self to another identity, as in art, provides a vantage point for this outer view, but I think carries with it a range of problems and perils. Tolstoy's short story, How Much Land Does a Man Need?, which James Joyce considered the greatest short story in all literature, describes a man hungry to acquire more and more land whose quest is answered by the provision of a sufficient amount of land for his own body, his grave. In the story, he is unable to emancipate himself from his own ambitions and understand mortality. Tolstoy also explores the necessity of overview in his innovative The Sevastopol Sketches about Russian citizens and soldiers during the siege of Sevastopol in the Crimean War. It is interesting that Crimea, too, provided the setting for a superb critical political artwork by another passionate patriot, Tennyson's The Charge of the Light Brigade, again allowing a compassionate but sternly judicious overview. Someone had blundered. When the other in descriptions of war is one's own side, as in the example above, there seems to be a strong opportunity for emancipatory perspective, as one's own side is newly presented as the exotic other, a subject of interest, and then examined with care. But we have also been discussing Rupert Murdoch and the MI6 CIA Mockingbird Press. In these, the other in war is a demonized caricature, described with the diction of ridicule and sexual loathing, and the photographs are often as doctored as the prose. We are seeing that again, of course, in the current propagandization of the conflict in the Ukraine. Does the demonized other still offer transcendence? And if so, what kind and by what means? In one of my poems, I observed that a vagina or a penis is always first person, and this is the first thing to consider when the other is demonized sexually. This can even be to the extent of the false report that Gaddafi's soldiers were issued with Viagra so that they could rape and pillage better. There is usually a familiarly contemptuous abbreviation to describe the current demon, such as Vlad, to underline their intimate context. What is the effect on the reader of emancipating from their own reality into the viewpoint of what seems to be a tyrannical libido? The calculation of the Mockingbird Press is that there will be illicit empathy and then a repudiating rejection, one that is more exaggerated by psychological denial of one's own hidden desires. It should also be noted, however, that the demonized other does still necessitate a second perspective and may engender complications not envisaged by the Murdochian insiders. I always remember that scene in Capra's least ingratiating and best film, The Bitter Tea of General Yen, in which the young female missionary has a nightmare in which she is sexually attacked by a caricature of the Chinese warlord, and then in the same dream is being rescued by a benign depiction of the same man. Freud's The Wish and the Fear again. To return to the subject of using gypsies to create a critical otherness, it is valuable to consider the work of the important 19th century author George Borrow and his attentive accounts of living with gypsies in Lavengro and the Romany Rye. Borrow also wrote sympathetically about the Russians and the Welsh, with a particular emphasis again on the nature of their languages and his attempts to speak them. Explicit often in his work is a preference for these other races against his native English society. We are not dealing with an exotic curiosity, but an expansive alternative. Lavengro was first published by the well-established publishing house John Murray in London in 1851, and whilst there was some doubt if it were fact or fiction, it's both, it was popular with readers, some of whom absorbed its new perspectives against racial narrowness. It was as well firmly feminist in attitude, making sure to detail the thoughts and way of life of the women in the cultures observed. John Murray was founded in 1768 and had a history of publishing unlikely but ultimately completely logical authors such as Borrow, Austen, Goethe, Darwin, Conan Doyle, Byron and Queen Victoria. In 2004, it came under the Hachette UK brand, owned by the French conglomerate Le Jardin, which is the third largest trade publisher in the world, publishing 17,000 original titles annually, the group owning several business ventures, including entertainment venues and travel. Arnaud Le Jardin was appointed as chairman and chief executive officer when the company converted to a joint stock company in 2021. He is the son of Jean-Luc Lagardère, former chairman of Matra and Hachette, and was director of Société Géante, a French holding company for defence, aeronautics and space, from 2007 to 2013, member of the board of directors of the European Aeronautic Defence and Space Company from 2003 to 2013, and member of the Conseil Stratégique des Technologies de l'Information, Strategic Information Technologies Council, from 2004 to 2007. As often, there is a strong link between publishing and the patriotic industries. Arnaud Le Jardin, who was a friend of Sarkozy, became even more famous in France for a demonstratively affectionate video he made with his to-be second wife, the model Jade Foray, who began her career with Armani at the age of 13 and is the co-author of the Amber Blake graphic novels. Some in France suggested the video was a lapse in taste, reflecting his business inexperience, but he pointed out that it helped to publicise her career and his, and there is no doubt that reinforcing the direct link in the French public mind between publishing, power and sexuality was a very memorable strategy. We should next consider the seminal French novel The Story of O, its literary and cultural significance, and its implications in terms of author-publisher relationship. Anne de Clos, writing under pseudonyms Dominique Horry and Pauline Reage, wrote the novel as a series of erotic letters to her lover and employer, Jean-Paul Anne, director of Nouvelle Revue Française, who was an enthusiast for the work of the Marquis de Sade and who, like de Clos herself, had fought in the French Resistance. The latter fact is very important, as the left wing of the Marquis in World War II became, in post-war France and the world, a great force to recommend the anti-colonial and the sexually liberated, and tended to associate those two rebellions profoundly. The sexually explicit anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist viewpoint is most famous in the works of former resistance writers like Beauvoir and Sartre, but it is even more complex when we observe de Clos and her relationship with Pollan. In public initially, de Clos's authorship of The Story of O was hidden, but Pollan was its public champion and explicator, so that it was always seen as part of the social campaign for sexual liberty. We should remember here that, from the French perspective, the Marquis de Sade was an influential social revolutionary, being supported by many in the French Revolution as a critic of the aristocracy. He was even appointed a magistrate, but the revolutionaries lost some enthusiasm for him when he was reluctant to pronounce death sentences, even for his aristocratic mother-in-law, whom he detested. His humanity in this regard, of course, reinforced for his later admirers like Pollan the connection between sexual openness about sadomasochism and the acquired lack of an aristocratic compulsion to practice actual political cruelty in declaring to Pollan that she wished to emulate Sade. De Clos was positioning herself as someone supporting personal and political growth, and allowing Pollan to define her work as both feminist and sexually courageous. She had explained to him that she was refuting his claim that women could not write erotic literature. I am reminded of the renowned American photographer Alfred Stieglitz's exclamation when he first saw the paintings of his future partner, Georgia O'Keeffe, at last a woman on paper. By showing her older lover, Pollan, the early manuscript of The Story of O, in confidence and ostensibly as an act of courtship, de Clos removed it from the province of her own respectable literary, translating and publishing career, and ensured that it would be incorporated in his ego and published in a wilder and wider ocean.